So please help me give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, John A. from the Gracious Living Home Group.
Thank you, Jim. Hey, I'm John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
I would like to thank Mike for inviting me to his home group to speak. It means the world to me. My sobriety date is May 1st of 2025. And so I'm no mathematician, but I have this app called Everything AA, and that tells me that's 309 days. And that is a miracle to me. So I guess my purpose here is to tell everybody here and share my experience, my strength, and my hope with all of you. And really my goal here is, if I say one thing that resonates with you, that fuels your fire to get to the next meeting, I think I've served my purpose, which is serving out God's will. That's what I've been taught. And so I'm here to share my what it was like, what happened, and where I'm at today. And so I see my sponsor in the room. My sponsor is Aaron. He has helped me tremendously through just understanding these steps. And I've truly had a spiritual experience just by taking the suggestions and following the doctrine, which is this big book. That's what I've been taught. And so I'll start off by saying that I was an outcast in life. I had parents who, they struggled with the same disease that I have today. You know, they struggled with alcohol, they struggled with drugs, and, you know, they're no longer with me today. And, you know, I grew up in Southern California, and I was, some of my earliest memories, you know, I was in foster care. And, like real coincidences, which I honestly don't believe there's such thing as coincidence after all of my life. Like the fact that I was almost adopted as an infant to people who were foster parents who had the same last name as me, Middleton. I'm like, wow, what the hell's that? Like, pretty crazy, right? And the only baby pictures I have today of myself are from them. They found me later on the social media, back when I had the social media, and you know, they gifted me, they blessed me with my baby pictures. I'm like, that in itself was a spiritual experience to me, because it's just amazing. I'm a parent today. I have two boys, an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old, and it's just amazing to see how much they look just like I did when I was a kid. And so, yeah, like, then my mom got sober, right? And then I learned about Alcoholics Anonymous as a kid. And so from like age 7, you know, I grew up in Corona, California. They had this place called the Serenity Club. And I've never seen my mom do so well in life when she was working this program, that when I was a kid, I didn't understand anything. All I knew is that I used to go to this place, you know, oftentimes after school or early in the mornings. My mom actually worked at the Serenity Club. That's literally what it was called, the Serenity Club. They had cups on the wall. This whole wall of white cups with people's name on it. They had pinball machines. And I got to sit on the sidelines of the walls and listen to people say a bunch of their life story and just keep saying, you know, and I'm like, no, I don't know. But, you know, I always wondered why there was like strangers in my house all the time. I didn't know what was going on, but there were really strangers in my house, and my parents just seemed to be doing really well. They had a good, like, grounding on spirituality. They seemed very happy. You know, there was no longer ashtrays flying across the room, and we were going camping, and it was great for like 7 years growing up, and literally going to Al-Anon, going to Alateen, and being in these rooms, and like, they're some of the nicest people in these rooms I ever met as a kid. You know, I'm like, through the age of 7 through like 12 years old, I don't remember specifically, like my younger brother, he used to get suspended a lot from school, and like, you go in, and like, he couldn't go to school, so he'd hang out in the AA, and like, a bunch of drunks would buy him candy and coffee, and not coffee, sodas and stuff like that, and just cheer him up. And it's just like, you know, it seems like every time I go to these rooms and somebody's down, there's always somebody very quickly to pick you right back up. And so, you know, as I grew up, like, past the age of 12, unfortunately, I had to, like, live through the fact that my parents relapsed. And then overall, I was in like two or three foster cares. I can't remember. I was like, a lot of it's grayed out and blacked out now because I don't know how the brain works, but I lost a lot of these memories. Like, don't know all of my teachers' names, and it was pretty traumatic. And like, just, I had to go through a lot of adversity. And I want to talk about my first drink. So when I was, the first time I ever tasted alcohol ever was when I was like six or something like that. It was before my parents sobered up, and my mom, she asked me if I wanted to try this drink. And it is what I know today to be a bottle of Patron. I drank it right out of the bottle, and man, it like burned. It was like liquid fire. And I'm like, I'm never gonna have that again. No way. Not a chance. And you know, growing up through like listening to these meetings as a kid and going to Alice, I was telling myself the whole time, I'm never gonna become an alcoholic. There's no way. It ain't happening to me. Not a chance. And anyways, like, as I, you know, I go to three different high schools. One funny story, here's a funny story, is like, and I'll tie it in later, but one day, it was the day I graduated junior high. My mom, you know, she was working at the Serenity Club, and I go there. She worked behind the counter. She's like the cashier. They sold snacks and, you know, washed the coffee cups and, you know, took people's dues and things like that. And I'm headed out to go skateboard with my friend, and she says, look both ways before crossing the street. And I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever, you know, just being a kid full of pride, not really listening. I was not the best listener. And you know, that day I was going across the street, I got hit by a Ford F-150 going like 35 miles an hour, and I like smashed my teeth all over the asphalt. Like, they called the ambulance, my mom showed up, and the ambulance, like, the cops handed my teeth to my mom, and she's like flipping out. And so I had to go through high school for 4 years without teeth. And I went to three different high schools. And so I was an outcast. I wasn't good at making friends. I don't even know how I had a girlfriend in high school. I didn't say much to her. I sat in front of her, you know what I mean? I didn't smile ever. She probably thought it was the coolest, most awesome, like, and I'm trying really hard not to curse. I'm a military veteran. It's hard. So I told myself, you know, I was a bad A. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I thought that she thought, you know, because I never smiled. But what it gifted me with is the ability to listen. I had to sit through school in high school for three different high schools for 4 years, and I was afraid to talk. I know, like, I would get called waffle teeth, and I've heard them all. And so I just listened, and it turned out okay for me because, you know, When I got through, you know, ultimately after the 7 year stint or 8 year stint that my mom was sober, I watched her deteriorate away. I watched her, you know, when the ashtray started flying back across the room and all the profanities and the arguments started happening again, I watched it in real time. And then I'll never forget, there was a day I came home from school and there was the sheriff standing out in front of the house and all of our stuff was just sitting on the lawn. And if anybody's ever been evicted, you know what that means. Like, I can't count how many times we've lost our baby pictures. That's why I said the reason I got our pictures back was because the grace of God. I mean, he somehow, my foster mom, who coincidentally had the same last name, reached out. That's the only reason I have those baby pictures. And so, you know, I was homeless twice growing up, like literally living in cars, living at friends' houses, couch surfing. And, you know, I just still wasn't an alcoholic yet. And so when it really started to pick up was, my way out of California was by way of the military. I'll never forget it. There was a fight that my mom and dad were having, and you know, it was alcohol, but it was also drugs. My mom was like a grade A tweaker. She would sit and like etch glass, and like, she was great at it, like very artwork, like good stuff. But like, she would stay awake for 3 days, and like they would fight and fight and fight. And like, I would sit and zone out and do my homework. Like, that's what I would do, just to get out of it. And I'll never forget, like, there was a TV commercial. It was like, 1-800-423-USAF, you know, go fight for your country. And I'm like, good, I need to get out of here. So I called it up, and I was blessed with a recruiter that was willing to come pick me up from my house, give me my birth certificate and everything else that I didn't have. And, like, you know, he was also friendly enough to introduce me to his liquor cabinet. And so, you know, when I'm, like, 17, 18 years old, you know, we're going to do the recruiting stuff and like doing the physical fitness and stuff. But then later on, we'd go and like play video games and start drinking. And I'm like, ah, this is kind of cool. Like, I like the way this feels. You know, I wanted it the next day immediately. And so I just loved the way it made me feel. It was like instantaneous. I would just feel like, ah, this is like, man, I feel good. Just, you get like the warm like buzz throughout your whole body. And it's like, I liked it. And, but I didn't think about the fact that I never wanted to be an alcoholic. I didn't think it was possible. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. And so, you know, I joined the Air Force. I served for 10 years. I was an aircraft mechanic. And the whole military is just centric on drinking. I mean, that's what I did. I'll never forget the first time I bought alcohol for myself. It was on February 6th. And it was all 2 minutes before the clock struck midnight at a Circle K in Tucson, Arizona. I had a Mickey's 40, and I had like a Colt 45, and I put it on the counter, and the guy said, let me see your ID, and I pulled it out, and he looked at my ID, he looked at his watch, and he looked at the ID, and he said, you can wait 2 minutes. I'm like, all right. So, you know, I went home, and I drank those 40s. I felt great. Until the next day, I've never had a hangover like that. Like, it was so bad. And I was just puking my guts out the next day. And then, typical military culture, like, my buddies came in, happy birthday, let's go to the bar. And, I'll never forget. Like, I started drinking again, started feeling good again, you know, got rid of the hangover. I could not stop drinking, and I was drinking so rapidly that I ended up going to the bathroom around, and the bathroom was like on the side of the building, and I had to throw up, and there was no place to throw up. And like, all the stalls were taken. So I'm throwing up in the urinal as some guy is like peeing with his pants around his ankles. And he's like, it's about time that you go. And I'm like, yeah, whatever, shut the F up. And he's like, I own this bar. And I'm like, why are you peeing like that? Like, he kicked me out. And he kicked me out, and that bar is called Fender Skirts, which later on, the first time I had my rights read to me was by a military officer when I went on a drunken escapade and I blacked out. And the story goes, I was married before, I had my first wife. We would fight constantly, all the time. And so basically, as soon as she'd fall asleep, me and my buddy JT would look try to find a way out to go drink. As soon as she fell asleep on the couch, we looked at each other. We didn't even need to talk. We were out. Back to Fender Skirts. We drank our asses off. Sorry, said a bad word. Tried not to. Apologize. We drank all night until, you know, his fiance at the time comes rolling into the bar like, where's JT? We got to go. I'm like, I don't know, but you could give me a ride. And she gave me a ride home, which was like, oh, we could have walked. We actually, like, could have walked there. It was, like, not even far. It was, like, a five-minute walk. And I'm like, basically, like, when I get back to the house, I keep drinking until I black out, because that was my symptom, right? So my issues are, like, when I would drink, I would drink to the point of, like, I would outdrink everybody until they fell over, and then everything would just fade to black, and then I don't know what would happen after that. And then I couldn't, all that I would want to do at work and think about is like, how do I get this next one? All the time. Up until even recently, driving across the JRV, I'm like, all right, what time is it? You know, I just got the email for the Buffalo Trace. So I think if I get there at this time, I'm like calculating in my head how to get to the next drink. And I'm like stuck in this hamster wheel where if I'm thinking about alcohol, then that's all I'm doing. And the only time I'm not thinking about alcohol is when I'm drinking it. And it's crazy. And so, anyways, back to the story, like, about getting my rights read to me. Yeah, like, I don't know what happened during my blackout. Apparently, I went running around the streets, and, you know, apparently I called my friend saying somebody was trying to get me or beat me up, is what he tells me. I don't have any recollection of it, but when he went looking for me, he was very intoxicated, and, like, he rolled through a cul-de-sac, and, like, his car hit another car that was parked, and that car rolled into a house and, like, hit somebody's toilet and everything else. And, like, needless to say, I was involved in that situation, and, like, they're reading me my rights. And they're like, you know, you were involved in this, and, like, you're the world's worst wingman, and it was what they call, like, people in the Air Force. And it's like, I wasn't even thinking about the alcohol. I was like, well, he could have got a ride. You know, I'm pointing the finger at him. And so, you know, another story that I could share, and I don't want to share too much into the war stories. I got plenty of them. You'll find me after the meeting. But, like, I've been to so many different countries. So for the first 5 years in the Air Force, I was in Tucson, Arizona, and just doing aircraft maintenance and drinking in Tucson. Like, that's it. And I met my wife in Tucson right before I got orders to Kadena Air Base in Japan. And when I was in Japan, I was part of a special operations unit that we traveled everywhere. So I know the countries I've been to, but I don't know what I did in the countries. It's the truth. And so I've been to like Australia, Cambodia, Indonesia, Thailand. And I'm like, what did I do there? I know I've been to Chiang Mai, Thailand. And like the one thing that sticks out is like, there was a time where literally I lived the movie The Hangover. Like if you've seen it, like I woke up, I had a chipped tooth, and I followed the blood trail to the bathroom, and I'm like, I don't even know how I got here. I don't even know how I got home. And like there was a hole through, I still got a scar through and through my lip. And so like I just go next door and like knock on the door to the IDMT, who's like the medical guy in our special operations group, and I'm like, yo man, like you gotta stitch me up. I think I fell in the shower. He kicks the hookers out of his room, and like he's angry. And like he has no anesthetic, so he's like literally stitching me up, and I'm so intoxicated that I can't feel any of it. And you know, I go to work looking like I just got in a bar fight the next day, and they're looking at me like, you need to fill out this safety report, what happened? I'm like, I think I slipped in the shower. And you know, I just kept getting away with it all the time. And so they actually, I was married at that time, my wife, who's still my wife by the grace of God, Laura, you know, they called her up and she's like, what happened? And I'm like, I don't know what happened. I think I slipped in the shower. You know, and I told her I was drunk. And she just accepted it. And, you know, I did a lot of things overseas that I'm not very proud of. Like, I could have used the thing that the steps taught me, though, is just not to hold myself feeling guilty. And I've been able to get over pretty much all of it. And, you know, I never closed the door on it. And so it keeps me humble. These are good memories to me now because it keeps me in check on what it was like. And like, I was in the trenches at times. There's times where, I mean, we would just go back after work and we'd finish a whole handle between me and my buddy, Captain Morgan, almost daily. I mean, I remember from the time we were playing beer pong to where it turned into liquor pong, and we were playing liquor pong, like I'm throwing up on ceilings and just, it got bad. It got really bad. And, but I always knew this program, Alcoholics Anonymous, because I was stuck in the room. But like the tricky thing is, I'm like, I didn't really know the definition of an alcoholic. You know, there was times, like during a Super Bowl Sunday one time where I drank by myself a whole 36 pack of Coors Light. And my wife is looking at me and I'm like in tears, you know. And I was like, I think I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And of course, like 2 days later, I'm like, nah, I'm crazy. You know, I'm tripping. I could control this. You know, I don't have a problem. It was a one-off, you know, it was an edge case, which had a lot of those. So, you know, things for me, like I've heard in a lot of these rooms got worse, you know, like that first step it talks about, there's the part about your life being unmanageable. Like, I didn't know about that. I never considered that. Until, you know, really last year when I was in my low. The lowest of the low is, and it's funny because I was talking to somebody in here tonight who's been in the same place I have. And, you know, if you've been to Satara Obese in the behavioral health unit, I was there for 11 days. And, I mean, the food's good. Like, I'm constantly reminded of it every time I go to a doctor. I was just at my doctor's appointment yesterday and I got to see my picture. They updated my picture in there. I'm wearing the red, you know, scrubs, and I look like a crazy maniac, and so I'm just constantly reminded, you know, that was like one of two behavioral health units that I ended up in, and, you know, it humbled me, for sure, and I hid my alcoholism very well from them, too. I struggled also, like, in my lowest of the low, I was drinking every single day, unless there was days where I would throw up to the point where I'd like pop blood vessels in my face, then I would take a break. And but I was also like, you know, I went to the doctor one time and I was like, my wife, she's just always on my case and I can never do anything right. And I think it's my focus. And they're like, you got ADHD, take this test, fill out these papers. I'm like, okay. And so they gave me this drug called Adderall. And so, you know, in the lowest of the low, I was taking Adderall which was great. Like I was so zoned in and focused on everything, and I needed to ease it out. And so I would drink too, just to kind of calm down a little bit and satisfy that craving. And then like when it was like too much and it wasn't working, like when the drinking wasn't working and the Adderall was keeping me too hopped up, then I would just smoke weed. And so that little like triple cocktail of doing all that, it literally drove me insane, to the point of just straight up delusional. You know, I was saying some things that I don't remember saying. I was doing some things that, you know, I'm not the proudest of. And ultimately it led to my wife. She wanted out. She wanted a divorce. And it got really real for me when I came home one day and there was custody paperwork on the counter. Stack of paperwork from the court. You need to be on court on this day. And, you know, my wife was seeking full custody of the kids. So, you know, like, I had to do something. And I could have drank, you know, I really could have. I was thinking about just keeping drinking, and then I just kind of started praying. And I just walked into an AA meeting one day. And it was hard because I walked into this meeting, and it was a meeting in Carrollton at Centara, and it was like me and just like four ladies. I would call them old ladies, but I tried that one time and it didn't work out too well. So there's four ladies in there, and I'm like, well, like, I'm thinking, like, is this what every AA meeting is going to be? Is just like me and these like four ladies, because that's not going to work. But they gave me this book, and they gave it for free, and it's like, it's a big, big book. And I'm like, you know, when I went home, I'm like, I don't think I'm going to go to another one. And I picked up the book, and I just started reading it. And I'm like, okay, like, it pretty much describes me. That's amazing. So I went to another meeting, and it was that meeting that I ran into my sponsor. And, you know, he, like, was willing to listen to me when I was at an all-time low. And he was able to empathize with me. And he wasn't too pushy. You know, he was able to hear my problems. And he told me, this too shall pass. And he believed it. And I kept coming back. So I want to talk about kind of the solution that's worked for me so far. And it's in these steps. It really is. Like, my book is like, it's just, I learn something new every meeting. And this book means a lot to me. Because my mom had the same book. Like, not this physical same book, but like it was the same blue big book with the big writing. And I used to see it sitting on her bed all the time, full of highlights. Man, that book means a lot to her. And I gotta talk about my mom for a minute. This is gonna be a hard one. The last thing I told my mom was that I hated her. And then she died. And so that was one of my things through my ninth step, you know, that I'm still working, that I'm moving through. And so she died chasing another drink, literally. Like, she had the alcoholic's dilemma, which is, at least I call it that. It's like the alcoholic's dilemma, I define as when you have a half a handle of alcohol and you finish it and you want more. And she went to go get more. And like, I have the police reports and everything. And like, my stepdad at the time, who was also an alcoholic, was begging her not to go. He was chasing her, trying to get her not to go. And she was barefooted crossing the street. And that was the last street she crossed. And there, I tied it back in. So if you hear me, Mom, you should look both ways before you cross the street. That's what he told me, right? And so, yeah, she got hit by a van and it was instant. She died instantly. And I like to think there was no pain involved. And so she went to go get another bottle. And that's like, that seems to be a trend that I hear in these rooms, is that this is a deadly disease. My stepdad died not 5 years later, and he died the long and slow and painful death with liver disease. And we watched that happen. It's like psoriasis or cirrhosis or whatever it's called. you know, my liver enzyme numbers were going up too, and I'm like, man, like, this could be me. And so all these things that I'm thinking about the whole time, I'm like, I need to go to AA, and I'll try it out. And I've never stopped coming. I mean, I look forward to it. And so let me do a time check. Yeah, not too bad. I've got 15 minutes left, and I could share the solution. So I'm no expert to this stuff, and, like, I'm going to caveat this by saying, like, if it sounds anything egotistical or prideful, I'm hoping there's an old-timer in the room to come take me aside later and give me the feedback on to make sure that, you know, I'm not speaking out of the side of my neck, because I'm still new at this stuff. And so this is a spiritual program of recovery. That's what it is. That's the way it's been explained to me. And I want to share a quick story about my higher power. And I've been blessed that, like, I grew up agnostic. I was in a Christian church as a kid, and I got bullied a lot in that church. So I stepped away from it. You know, as soon as they gave me the option, like, do you want to go to church? I started saying no. And I was agnostic. I thought that, like, when we die, like, it just goes black and nothing happens. You know, like, I didn't think anything of it. In fact, I was the person who was very prejudiced against people who had any religion or spirituality. And I would actively try and talk them out of it. And so I think it's chapter 4. Is it chapter 4? We agnostics? It is. So, like, my God story that happened to me, coming from, like, homelessness, I somehow worked my way all the way up to, I was working for Apple in my highest of the highs, even though I was, like a very high-functioning alcoholic. And so I was a test engineer at Apple, and I had, like, the six-figure salary, and, like, my ego, I don't even want to talk about it because my ego will get out of control. But my ego at the time was like, I got myself here. I dug myself out of this hole. Like, that's a whole different story. Just understand that, like, if there's a food pyramid of, like, pride and ego, I was, like, sitting at the top of it. Trust me. I was at the top of it. I mean, I would brag about it. I would just tell people how great I was. And I'm like, man, if it wasn't for this program, you know, I had to look up the definition of humility. I did. And I was like, wow, like, everything was making me so important, and I just couldn't see it. And so my God story is, like, the job I have now, I feel it was like calling from God to come to this job, because I've been working this type of work forever. And I was so scared one night about we were having to sell a business, sell a house, and this is all during COVID. Like, trying to sell a house during COVID is not easy, or trying to sell a business is not easy. It's like, I was scared. What do we do when we're full of fear? We drink. So I was drinking, and I got on my hands and knees in my kitchen when my family was asleep, and I said this prayer. It was like, dear God, if you're real, I'm sorry. Like, I need help. I'm scared. I don't want to fail. You know, one little brick could come out, and the whole castle could come falling down. And God, I'm sorry if you're real, period. If you prove to me that you're real, I will stop judging your people. That's what I told them. And I'll also spread this message one person at a time. All right, God. And then, you know, in Jesus Christ's name I pray, amen. That's just what I said. I'm a Christian. I'm not trying to sell any religion. But the next day, when I was doing some stuff around the house, and I didn't sleep that night. I actually stayed up all night, just kept drinking. And then I didn't black out that time. I just kind of laid in bed and was just thinking about what I just did. I don't know why I did it, but I knew I was scared. And so the next day I ended up telling my wife, I'm like, hey, like, you know, if you see me start, and I was the most judgmental person, back to the food pyramid, you know, like, I'm at the top of the food pyramid of, like, hey, if you're walking funny, if you look silly, if you're not going, if I'm not in control, and if it's not my way, it's dumb. And, like, I just was so judgy all through high school, too. Like, the guy coming from the toothless guy, really. Like, and so I told my wife the next day, I'm like, Laura, like, if you see me start to judge people, I need you to call me out. She's like, what are you talking about? I'm just, you know, I don't know. Just help me out here. She's like, all right. And so, you know, I asked this higher power thing, and this is before I even went back to AA, like, prove it to me that you're real. And, like, the next day, a sequence of events happened, and I'll try and summarize it real quick, where, like, we're pulling into a parking lot, I see a gentleman that looks like a meth head, and my brain starts to like turn, and I'm like, oh, meth head. And I'm like, gonna say something to my friends, and I'm like, he's broken down. His car was broken down. And so instead of judging him, I went and helped him. And the sequence of events that happened is that, like, we put a new tire on his car, a new used tire that my friend had. When he tried to drive away, he broke down again, and we simultaneously, in the car that we were in, we broke down. And so now we're both broken down. So I called my wife, and all the while, some guy just that I used to see, I used to drive to this black site, is what they call them at Apple, where we're doing this test project, and like, I see this guy walking every day with this cane, with pure white hair, and I was like, always wondering, what does this guy do? He's dressed like a cowboy, and I would see him every day on my way to work. He showed up in the situation and just started talking scripture, like Bible stuff. And I'm like, oh, weird. Like, I just prayed last night. This guy's talking the Bible, and like, we just both broke down. And I'm trying to help. I'm trying to influence everybody to help this one guy. That guy had been stuck there for 2 days, and he was in tears. This guy's dog hasn't been fed in 2 days. He's giving up. He's giving up hope. And I'm relentlessly trying to help. And so what ended up happening is the tire we put on to his truck was one size too big. So I go to my buddy Brett, who's a Mormon, and I'm like, hey man, like, what are the odds that you just downsized your tires and like your spare tire, the brand new one on your truck, is gonna fit his? He's like, F no, he's not getting my tire. I'm like, he's just cursing up a storm because his car just broke down. You know, it gets really crazy when a guy on a Harley Davidson pulls up and pulls a serpentine belt out of his Harley. I can't write this stuff. He's like, your serpentine belt broke? I'll sell you this one for $30. I'm like, I'll give you $60 for it. He's like, you can have it for free. So Brett's calling O'Reilly's, getting the parts, and I'm like, Laura, take me home, I'm tired. You know, I did convince Brett to give this spare tire to this guy, and we watched that guy drive off. He was elated. And I'm like, man, I could have judged him. I could have, you know, but I didn't. I felt God's presence. As soon as the serpentine belt came out, I fell down and started crying. My wife's like, what's wrong with you? I'm like, shoot. You don't even want to know. You don't even want to know that I prayed last night. You don't know what I asked for. God showed his presence to me. That was my spirit. It was a white light moment for me. And then, you know, when I called up Brett after I finally got some sleep, I'm like, hey, man. And Brett's the guy who drove us there. You know, tell me a story. He's like, well, here's a funny story. It's like the serpentine belt and the tensioner bearing that seized up that I bought it at, you know, I bought it at O'Reilly's. And keep in mind, like, he just replaced these parts 2 weeks ago. This is a true story. 2 weeks ago, he replaced a serpentine belt and a tensioner bearing, and it seized up and broke again. I'm like, huh, that's kind of weird. Maybe he didn't do it right, whatever. But, like, the serpentine belt he got from O'Reilly's, when he tried to install it, it was one size too big. The serpentine belt that the random Harley Davidson guy who injected himself on the situation pulled out of a Harley and, like, handed to us for free after I tried to overpay for it, it fit perfectly. And I'm like, man, everything worked out. And it was because I just didn't judge somebody. It was like a ripple effect. But anyways, like, what's worked for me? Time check. It says on in We Agnostics, and I say this because, like, what's worked for me most in this program, like, the keystone to it has been the spirituality. It's been the quiet time, the meditation, the prayers, asking for God's will, begging for his will, asking him to keep myself out of all the situations. And when you do that, like, at least in my experience, I mean, I got stories for days, you know? And if you try and set expectations on what could happen, expect that sometimes the complete opposite will happen, you know? It says on page 40, it's on all over page 46, 47, 48, we found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and even express a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. And they say it so much in this chapter. It's like 47. Besides a seeming ability to accept much on faith, we found ourselves handicapped by obstinacy, sensitiveness, and unreasoning prejudice. Many of us have been so touchy that even casual reference to spiritual things made us bristle with antagonism. I'm like, if that doesn't define me, my whole life as an agnostic, I'm like, this is just speaking to me. It says, again, down here, we hope no one else will be prejudiced for as long as some of us were. I'm like, it says it three times on two pages. I'm like, it's been told to me that, like, the way that, you know, Mr. Bill wrote, when he's reiterating it multiple times, you might want to key in on that. And so I practice spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. I'm still judging, but I try it to the best of my ability not to be. And so the step work for me, and I'll try and wrap it up, is like, I had to get a sponsor because I don't know what I'm doing. There's so much words in this book, and I have like ADHD. I don't know if you all have that, but like I have it to where I can't focus. My brain moves 1,000 miles an hour, and I at least need an instruction or a guide or somebody to help me through. And I'll tell you what, Aaron is, he served me so well. Like, he started me off at the preface, you know, into the doctor's opinion. And I've read that doctor's opinion so many times now that, like, even the doctors are saying that, hey, there's some, we can't explain this phenomena. They use the word phenomena so many times because they can't explain it, you know, but it's, there's no, there's something else outside spiritually that helps ease our pain. And so step one, two, and three weren't that hard for me, because I have had the spiritual experience. And the crazy thing is, like, I went from not, in a matter of 24, 48 hours, I went from not believing in God at all, I was agnostic, to continuing to not believe in God. I don't believe in God. I know He's real. I know it at this point. And when I say my prayers now and I have my thoughts, like I truly know that He's with me, this higher power. And it's totally reframed my thinking. But still, I could not stop drinking. And so step one, admitting that I was powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable. I mean, you heard it tonight. I had the paperwork on the counter to prove it. And step two and three, I didn't, you know, my praying was wrong. It was wrong. The way I was doing it was so foxhole and selfish. It was me, 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 and God, I want. Like, I think, personally, I feel that God knows what you want, but he also knows what you need, right? And there's two different things there. And so I reframed the way I prayed, and I only pray on others now to the best of my ability and for God's will. I'll literally, if I talk to you and I say I'm praying for you, I'm praying for you. I have it written down. I do it. And miracles have happened from that. Step four and five, to me, helped shed some of my ego. I think, like, I'm always going to have ego. But, like, really, it wasn't until I had somebody who I asked, who wasn't my wife or my uncle, telling me, you know, I asked them to, you know, go through this list with me. And, like, I had to make these columns and write it all down. And he was gracious enough to give me his story, unfiltered. And I'm like, wow, he was so open to me about all this stuff. I'm obligated now to give mine. And to the best of my ability, I wrote it all out. And we went through it all. And then he told me what I didn't want to hear, which is what I needed. You know, like, he straight up, like, I tried to do somebody else's inventory. That's what I did. I went in and I started trying to say, oh, it was he and then. He said, no, I don't want to hear about them. I want to hear about you. Where are you at fault for this? And I never thought about it like that. And I'm like, dang it, I asked for this too. So, and he told me a story. So now I'm obligated. And what ended up happening was, you know, right after this Matt Talbot retreat that I've gone to for the past two retreats, we sat and did a fifth step. And that really helped me to understand at least some of my character defects. And through step six and seven, I tell people that gave me, God gifted me with 1 second. He gifted me 1 second. That 1 second now reminds me, hey, you're full of these character defects. And when I'm sitting in traffic about to lay on the horn for the guy who's clearly on his phone and the light turns green, I don't have to do that anymore because I know that I'm impatient. And so, you know, I was ready and I humbly asked God to remove these character defects, and I'm still uncovering them, and I'll still go through, and if I have to do another fifth step, I'll do it. And the cool thing is, and I could share it, like, I got 1 minute, but I quit biting my nails just because I asked God to remove it from me. And that's a true story. I've been in my whole life. And I was like, I just don't want to do it anymore, God. Like, it's character defect. I don't like it. And it just stopped. And it's like, if you ask and you truly know that He's real, not just a Santa Claus or Tooth Fairy belief, don't be surprised if quickly it could happen. And He removed the character defects. And so right now where I'm at in the program, before I wrap it up, is steps 8 and 9. I made the list of at least the people I know that I'm willing to make amends to. And I've made amends. I've made many of them so far. And, like, they get easier. They get easier and easier. And you feel better and better. So I'd say 50% of my fear-driven anxiety was resolved from the fourth and fifth step. And the other 50%, where I'm almost feeling serenity, was 8 and 9. And then through 10, which I've actually had to use multiple times throughout the week, and my boss just told me I'm not getting a raise, I had to spank my kid, I know what to do now, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And it clears my thinking, and I pray to my higher power, and like I don't have to hold on to anxiety about it anymore. And then, you know, I'm just getting into 11 and 12. And so, you know, with that, I think that's my time. I'm very grateful to be here. And it's like every person here, I'm thankful to all of you for sharing your stories, because I take away something new every time I'm here. It's always something new getting highlighted. And it's like I look at things so much differently. And like the biggest thing I've ever gotten from this is the ability to empathize and practice at least somewhat levels of humility that I never even thought were possible for myself. So with that, thanks for letting me share my story. And I look forward, if anybody wants to get my phone number, come find me after this. Thank you.